Editor X is a platform built specifically for designers and agencies with the sole purpose of empowering you to create complex websites in a simple, completely visual way. Editor X gives you a wide workspace with total CSS control powered by smooth drag and drop on a platform where every tiny detail has been carefully considered. That means that you can let your creativity run wild and build your most creative sites yet. I can keep trying to describe it to you, but you really should go see it for yourself. Visit userdefenders.com/editorx and discover a new standard in web design.
All you do all day as a user researcher is understand real people's life's experience in different contexts. There's always new things about learning, okay, these are all real people doing real things and they're all different from me. And so I guess it exposes you to how broad users as a category are and what people are like in the real world. And I think that's endlessly interesting.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 76. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. My guest today is games user researcher, author, and speaker, Steve Bromley. In this episode, Steve shows us how to level up our user research skills. He illuminates the path to getting started as a games user researcher. He inspires us to use our user research superpower and insights to make things better for our users. He teaches us techniques he's used to actually enjoy synthesizing data more. He reveals how many users is enough. Spoiler alert, it depends. He challenges us ethically to be responsible for the consequences of what we're designing. He also motivates us to document as we go, but also to be sure and stop to reflect every once in a while. With huge thanks to Steve, I'm super excited to announce that I have in my possession 4 signed copies of his brand new book, How to Be a Games User Researcher, to give away to 1 lucky defender, actually 4 lucky defenders. Stay tuned through the end of the episode to discover how you can win a copy. I hope you're doing well, Defender, and now please enjoy this inspiring and insightful deep dive with Reflector, Steve Bromley. Defenders, I have with me today Steve Bromley, user researcher expert. He's an author. He's written a couple of books now, Building User Research Teams, and soon to be released at the time of this recording, How to Be a Games Researcher. Steve works with game studios to help them get insight from players to make games better. That's a very important thing. Just like you don't know how people are using your software, you don't know how players are using your games. So I'm excited to learn a little bit more about that. He's worked with Sony. He's done a lot of stuff there. So he's got a lot of experience. And I'm super excited to talk to him more about that. And here's a little fun fact. I like to start with these before we jump in. As a child, Steve was once on the Disney Channel advertising land yachting.
Sailing takes me away to where I'm going.
It's so random, but really pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's the only time I've ever done land yachting. It's quite an experience to do it on TV for the first time. I don't know if you've ever done it yourself.
No, what is land yachting for our education?
Well, you take a yacht. Well, actually, that's unfair. You take a canoe, you put some wheels on it and a sail on it, and then you just go down the beach as fast as you can. Obviously, it requires a very windy day, but yeah, exciting.
That's awesome. So, Steve, officially, welcome to User Defenders Podcast. I'm super excited to have you on the show today, my friend.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me on, Jason. I'm really excited to be here today.
We're going to talk a lot about user research around games, too, because that is really where you've focused a lot of your attention. And I know you've done traditional software as well. So I'm interested to really glean, and I know the defenders, too, especially around what is games user research. So we'll jump into that for sure. But before that, I want to start with the most important question that I'm going to ask, I think, during our time today.
I'm looking forward to this.
How do mere mortals get their hands on a PS5?
Oh, yes. So I gather the easiest way is to take a temporary job as a delivery driver and look out for someone ordering a PS5 and then just don't deliver it. I gather there's a lot of that going on.
I have a feeling there is. Oh, man. Imagine creating a product that people want that bad. I mean, that's pretty spectacular, right?
It's a really nice problem to have, isn't it? I imagine there's lots of businesses who would like to be in that position where as fast as you can make them, people will buy them. And yeah, it's an exciting time, I guess, with a new console generation, lots of people paying a lot of attention to what's coming out. And there's a lot of hype around it as well, which is exciting as well.
Definitely. Eat your heart out, Apple, right?
Exactly.
So I just want to reflect for a minute. I grew up in the 80s. I miss that generation so much. The more time goes by, the more I miss the 80s. But I just remember like going down the street and they had one of the early Atari 2600s and I saw Pac-Man on the screen for the first time. And they had this little black joystick with one red button. That was it. The neighborhood kids were all playing this game and I was just enamored. I couldn't believe that this was possible. If you look at Pac-Man now, you're like, crud, that's really cheesy, the graphics and everything. But back then, man, this was cutting edge stuff. This was outlandish. This was one of those aha moments, right? Mm-hmm. Wow, games inside of my home on a console. And so I reminisce and it hits a soft spot in my heart because those are my roots there, you know, and all that to say, we ultimately ended up getting a console. It probably took another year or two, but we got one for Christmas. That was one of the best Christmases ever. All that to say, Atari has really led the way, I think, in bringing video games into the home and being kind of the pioneers of that, if I'm not mistaken. I'd love to know more, maybe if I'm missing something. But also, I'm really curious because UX in general is still a pretty new, nascent even, movement in building software. It still is. You can look back, you can trace back to Don Norman in the 80s. And he was on to something, right? Don Norman coined the term user experience, worked at Apple. I know Atari did research on their games, right? So it's not necessarily new, but it's new to the masses. Let's say that, right? Mm. This is still a relatively new area to the masses. So all that said, I'm really curious, what are some of the differences and similarities to how Atari conducted user research in the 70s to say how Sony or Microsoft do it today?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary of the history of games user research as well. Because games is such a small field and so well documented, I think games user research is very lucky that we can see that history back. We can see, okay, this is the company that did it first and how they did it and then what happened next and then as it grew with games like Crash Bandicoot. So you asked about the similarities. The work that Atari was doing in the 70s is still fundamentally very similar to what we're doing today. They had employed a lady called Carol Kantor, who went to arcades in the first place to watch people playing games for real in the arcades. What she was doing there is the same as what user researchers do today. We're looking to see if people understand how the game works, what they're meant to do. Is it fun? Is it too difficult? Is it too easy? Balancing the game correctly. And that is still a lot of what we do. One of the problems that every user research field has, especially games, is the people who design games obviously care about games. They have stories similar to yours about their first encounter with games, and they play a lot of games all day long. And they become very different to a typical player just because of the amount of exposure they have to games in general and the game they're working on specifically. And so there's still that tremendous value of getting some players in, watching the players experience your game, realizing how the experience they're having is different to what the designer intends that experience to be, and then making changes to the game to bring that alignment between what we think players should understand and should do and what they're actually able to do. That doesn't mean that the field hasn't evolved since the 70s. You also asked about what's different between when Atari were watching people play games back in the 70s and what Sony or Microsoft are up to today with this kind of playtesting. Some of the areas where it has developed include bringing it earlier in the development process. So one of the problems if you're going to watch people play a game in an arcade is that game's already made. It's been printed on circuit boards and released everywhere. And if you do notice that game isn't working in the way you intended, you can't really do much at that point. You can't send out patches in those days or post-launch updates. So the problem is the things you learn in the arcade, you can only apply to your next game. You can't apply to this game. What games user researchers have done over the last decade or two decades is move earlier in that development process. So looking at prototypes and in development software so that it gives our game developers the opportunity to react to the findings for that game and fix the game that they're working on rather than just get learning some things that it might apply in their next game. I guess another area that games user research has evolved since the 70s is the methods available to us. So that original method of one-to-one testing where we have a player, we watch them play and we look at what they understand or don't understand and we ask some probing questions is still extremely valuable and one of the most impactful types of research we can run. But there's other types of questions that our game developers have that you can't answer with that kind of one-to-one session, like how difficult is this level? That will take some sort of quant measurement looking at how many times the players fail or how many times the people die or how are they rating this level. And to run that kind of study, you need a lot of people to come in to test the game. And that wasn't really possible in the same way in the arcades in the 70s. You could only do one-to-one studies at a time rather than these kind of mass testing that is possible now. But as I say, the fundamentals are still very similar.
Yeah, that's really insightful. I remember going to the arcades in the early 80s and man, Dragon's Lair. When I saw Dragon's Lair, it was like a cartoon you could control. And I was like blown away. Man. I was like, I just want to put all my quarters in this game, even though it was super difficult. Yeah. Because if you don't move that joystick at the right second, you're dead, right? But you get to see a cool animation at least to that end. But you touched on some interesting points that I hadn't really considered with video games, like I do with traditional software and even print. Mm-hmm. I think we really take the technologies we have available to us for granted. Younger defenders coming in, growing up with smartphones and things and really high-performing computers. And I really want you to know how blessed you are to be building software and designing software in this age, because everything was so much harder earlier on, right? Like even print, I mean, not to get too off track here, but I think about print in like the early days of advertising, right? Like everything was hand done. Everything was hand aligned. Your typography, your leading, the reason they call it leading is that they actually put strips of lead underneath the letters to space it out, to give it some readability. We just do two clicks on a computer and that's it. And then we can send it out print. And then I think about software, websites. And, you know, that's where kind of a lot of this started moving from was in website development at the infancy of the web. And then it became robust software solutions and e-commerce. So I'm just thinking around the fact that when you print something, if you misspell one word like a headline or something and you print 10,000 of those, guess what? You just wasted a lot of money and a lot of time to produce something that was wrong and you can't fix it. The only way you can fix it is to start over and then spend a bunch more money to get those 10,000 printed right. But with software, you make a misspelling, you can go in and you can correct that in about 10 seconds, upload it, and then the whole world may not have even noticed. And then I just going to the video game subject, arcade, that's where it was before Atari helped bring entertainment, video game entertainment into our homes. Mm-hmm. When they were doing research, they had to go into the arcade. Talk about the early guerrilla research, right? Mm-hmm. Like they had to go into the arcade, watch young people likely play these arcade games and just try to learn how they can make it better. And bugs, how do you even know, really? Like, right? I mean, you could probably test it in like your lab or whatever, or in your garage, wherever you're building these things, but you probably don't discover a lot of the bugs until you actually spent all this money, all this time shipping that game into a huge hardware console with graphics and everything. And then you got to make it again after you learn. And then you got to go. And I'm sorry to pontificate. I hope I'm not like pontificating too much, but I just feel like this is something we really ought to kind of take a step back and really kind of be grateful, show some gratitude about how lucky and blessed we are to be living in an age of agile and swift development. And that ties right into research, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just the tech that we are, the things we're testing that have changed over time and allowed us to make updates and iterate much quicker, but also the technology available to researchers. Early on, the work that PlayStation were doing to run usability studies on Crash Bandicoot, for example, they were recording those sessions on VCR tape so they could watch them back later. It's really interesting to see that mashup wow. of how what is incredibly simple these days for a researcher to share their screen, to give control to a participant, all those things that you have to do 10 times a day just wasn't possible back then, and you had to go a lot more low-tech solutions to these kind of things.
That's awesome, man. It's neat to learn about the history. I've honestly never thought about it, and I'm not a gamer mm-hmm. now, but I really appreciate, and again, like I said, I grew up with video mm-hmm. games, and I stayed up all night trying to solve Legend of Zelda with my buddies, you know, like drinking 6-pack of Jolt Colas, yeah. trying to just solve Legend of Zelda or Sonic the Hedgehog mm-hmm. and you know, all that stuff. This is really hitting a soft spot for me, man. It really is. It's very sentimental for me. And so I appreciate the craft, and I know my son is wanting a PS5 so bad, just like pretty much the rest of the world. But I could not believe, like, not having looked at a video game in quite a while mm-hmm. to having seen a display at Target, and I just can't believe how far technology has brought gaming. I really appreciate all of the work, all the effort that goes into creating this entertainment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting medium. I guess to build on your point about the changes as well, one of the things that makes games particularly exciting is the technology available to you. It's usually one of the first fields that sees new tech, like virtual reality headsets, a big thing in games for the last few years, hasn't really broken through to the rest of the consumer market yet. Things like the Wii a few years ago, which used a lot of motion gaming, and when that was very big about a decade ago. Again, as a researcher, it gives you new challenges that the rest of consumer software won't see for another 10 years or more. So some lovely research objectives and questions to work on there.
I kind of teased it a little bit, and you kind of touched on it a little bit in your response to my user research history question. But I'm curious, because I'm sure there are many, but what are the inherent differences and or complexities with doing UXR? I'll call it UXR, which stands for user research, for games versus general software. Can you dive into some of that for us?
Yeah, there's two areas that I think are particularly interesting. I guess the first one is the objectives. What are the research questions that you are being set as a researcher? Traditionally in software, you hear research objectives about efficiency, like can someone create a spreadsheet quickly, or can they order their taxi on a taxi ordering app within a few seconds and not get stuck? Efficiency is a lot less relevant for games. The most efficient game I could imagine is they could replace Mario with a button that you press, and the button says save the princess, and you'd press the button and save the princess. Obviously that's extremely efficient, but that's not the point of the games. Games are meant to have friction and meant to throw challenges that you can overcome. And so as a researcher, as well as that typical usability, can people do things, you're often brought questions about fun. Is this game fun and do people enjoy it? That's reasonably hard to measure, especially compared to efficiency, which you can measure things like time or errors. For fun, it's a lot more subjective and requires interesting study designs to experience, to understand, and then measure that experience. Things like benchmarking it against other games or trying to understand what are the reasons that make this game fun, rather than just relying on a player giving it 9 out of 10 on the survey. Another area I think is really interesting, and that difference between games user research and other forms of user research, is some of the setups that you require and some of the constraints that games introduce. So games have very large marketing budgets. I think it's well known that Microsoft, for example, spent more on the marketing of Destiny, one of their big games from a few years ago, than the actual development. And what that means is that games are very interested in secrecy. They want to be very clear what information is getting out in the public and stop anything from getting out. As user research works on prototype software or in development software, that means some of the methods that a user researcher would normally want to apply, like remote studies where you can screen share with someone playing at home, or sending someone something and then using analytics to measure it, aren't so possible because of that risk of leaks or stuff getting out in the public domain before it's ready. That means that you have to come up with workaround. A thing that's very common in the big studios like Ubisoft or Microsoft or Sony is having a playtest lab where they have 10 or 20 or 50 pods set up to bring players in. So you can start to answer quant questions by getting lots of people to play at the same time. But they come to you, whereas typically you'd want to do that remotely with other types of software. Again, it's just different approaches and different challenges of answering your research objectives that I think make games a really interesting subject to work on. Yeah, it's a great area.
That's great. There's definitely a lot of different questions to ask than creating the next car buying software or whatever, right? Methods. And you touched on it slightly, I think, with benchmarking, but I've asked this question certainly several times in the history of the show, and I've never really been satisfied with the answers. So no pressure, Steve, but you made a good point about how measuring delight is very difficult, but it's very important to the success of a video game. How have you been able to do that? What are some of the best ways that you've found to actually measure the delight of an experience?
Yeah, as you can imagine, it's the type of questions that game developers come to you all the time. They say, do people like my game and is it fun? And can you give it some sort of score? Everyone likes scores, I guess.
Yes.
Especially for games, because they get reviewed on websites and in magazines, and the review has a score. The whole industry expects scores, and also they assume that some sort of correlation between, well, players gave it a high score, so the reviewers are definitely going to give it a high score, whereas actually they're quite different people and they're not necessarily going to be the case. And you're right that it's really hard to measure delight or fun. So what a lot of teams will start with is asking for scores, but scores are ultimately not that useful. If you go to a developer and you say, well, your game is 7 out of 10, that's not so actionable. What are you going to do about it? You're like, okay, so it could be better, it could be worse, but it's 7. Great. Instead, one of the things that we think is more useful than just that fun score is understanding why a game is fun. And that can be very difficult because it's very easy to lead people. If you ask them, do you like the graphics? They will give you an opinion about the graphics, but that didn't necessarily mean it was a thing that they cared about in the first place. So there's some techniques that I know some user research teams use that employ a thing called grounded theory, where you try not to prompt the player or the participant about the subject. You let them talk freely about what they thought about the game, and then you identify, okay, the concepts they talked about were the graphics and the jumping and the weapons. And then you have some things that you can measure after that. So you can take each of those topics that they brought up by themselves and you can create a survey or do some sort of quant study to see how important these things are and how many people, whether people liked it or they didn't like, to avoid that risk of leading people. So I guess to come back to your point about the difficulty with measuring delight, is extremely difficult. It's a quant question, so you need a lot of people to do it. It's very easy to lead people down the wrong answer. But the approach I'd recommend is interviewing people to find out what's important with them and then measuring how many people that's important to create the size of those impacts.
I'm going to get to this question, but I'm going to ask it later. But I wanted you to put that in your back pocket about how many. Mm-hmm. How many users? Okay. Yeah. So just kind of priming you there. Okay. But I think it's interesting what you said about measuring the delight factor and even just showing graphics to somebody. Like, I think anybody can appreciate good graphics. I think we kind of know the difference now, especially in, again, thankfully, it took some time, but thankfully, a design-driven technology world. The average user understands whether an app, whether a software, whether a game is designed well or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing. It puts pressure on us as designers and researchers to get this right. And if not, to keep trying to get it right. Thankfully, like we said earlier, we can do that with software. But it was funny, you were talking about like, yeah, the graphics are great, but do you like it, mm-hmm. right? Like, is this fun? Would you play this game? And then it made me think about how in 2006, Taylor Hicks won American Idol. Mm-hmm. He beat Chris Daughtry. to win American Idol. And guess what? Nobody bought his record when it came out.
Yeah, that really...
Nobody!
That really highlights the difference, doesn't it, between making sure you're measuring the thing that's important. And what American Idol measures is, do you want this person to win a pop contest? Yeah, great.
Yes.
But it doesn't measure, will people buy the record of this person? That's a different thing, and you're measuring the wrong thing in that case.
Exactly. I have a rant about that, Defenders. I'll post it in the show notes. I got to say, a little humble brag here. I told Seth Godin about it because he's been a big inspiration of mine. And he read the article and he left a comment on it. So
nice.
That was one of the highlights of my very short writing career there.
I will check it out.
Anyway. Yes. Check it out. Yeah. I'll post it. I'll send you the link after and I'll post it in the show notes. But I talk about this kind of case study and it's a bit of a rant again about being picked. Because a lot of us going all the way back to childhood in school, we want to be picked for the kickball team. We don't want to be picked last. Even if we're picked like second or third from last, that's better. But my whole point was don't wait to be picked. Pick yourself. But you also mentioned about scoring. And I couldn't help but think about 7 out of 10. 10 what? Right? What's the criteria there? And I think about, you know, defenders. And I know that many of you are looking for a job in UX. You're either in transition or you're trying to get your foot in the door for the first time. When you're looking around, you'll see portfolio examples that have skills on them that folks are measuring themselves in use of like Photoshop or Figma or Sketch or any of these tools, right? My big question is 9 out of 10, what? Right? That's why I don't know if I'm crazy about those when I see those on a portfolio, but it's like, yeah, but what are you measuring against? So that's just a little rant there too, a little mini rant on that. Maybe reconsider that or try to test it with others, see if that is effective or not. But you just want to go, well, what's the scale? What are you measuring against?
Yeah, everyone likes measurements because they're easy to look at and easy to compare, but often it's very difficult to make the thing you're measuring actually be the important impact that you're trying to have on the world.
That's a good point. And then when you're trying to pitch your work too, to stakeholders, to executives, they want to see something. And so I can understand why score has some sort of score, some sort of quant would help convince them of the hard work that you've done and you've been able to synthesize that. And I know we're going to try to get into that a little bit later too. But before that, I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to challenge the defenders a little bit around gaming, because like I said, I appreciate the craft. I know how much work goes into this. I appreciate that there's a lot of really talented folks that are able to make a livelihood out of creating really groundbreaking and fun experiences for other humans. I appreciate that. Okay. So I am going to challenge this a little bit because ethics are very important, especially for defenders listening. We talk about fighting for the user, right? Like that's what really what the name of the show is. We're user defenders, right? I want to tell a quick story. My good friend's younger brother, he had everything going for him. He was engaged to be married. He had a great job. Life seemed really great for him. And then he started playing this game called EverQuest, also known as Evercrack. Okay. So I'm telling you, within a matter of months of just nonstop play of this game, he ended up letting himself go, stopped taking care of himself. His beard got really long and unkept. His fingernails grew. He lost his job. He lost his fiance. She left him. It all fell apart. Really fairly quickly, seemingly. He kind of became like a Howard Hughes. Have you ever seen the Aviator movie or read the Howard Hughes bio? He kind of became kind of a recluse. I'm not blaming the video game, but I think there's an interesting correlation to some of these life events and his unrelenting habit of playing this online role-playing game. And then there's the story of Sean Woolley, who was also an EverQuest player. And in 2001, I actually hadn't heard about this. I wasn't even looking for this when I was researching, but it came up. I will say he did have some mental and emotional disabilities. So I will put that out there. A schizoid personality disorder. But he killed himself. His mother found him basically with his head down right in front of the computer, and the computer screen had EverQuest on there. So she did a little correlation too on this. And it wasn't just that day. He had just shut his family out for months before that. He wouldn't let anybody into the house. He'd stop cleaning his house and just shut the world out. And he got emotionally involved with another player in this game. It was assumed that there was a player on the other side that he had actually romantically completely fallen for. Mm-hmm. And it was assumed that he was rejected somehow by this fictitious, I mean, that's a real person, but this was a character mm-hmm. in a game that rejected him. And we know, I mean, rejection hurts, man. It hurts mm-hmm. a lot. So, and if you have, again, combined with some of the mental and emotional disabilities this fella had, he's 21 or something at this time, and this was in 2001, he shot himself in mm-hmm. front of the computer. What I'm getting at here, in my long-winded way of asking a question around this, should video game companies and console providers, mm-hmm. should they take more responsibility and or action mm-hmm. to address the potentially addictive and destructive qualities of some video games? Do you think that these are designed for attention, man? Mm-hmm. They're designed to, just like social media. I'm not mm-hmm. going to let social media off the hook. I've had issues. I've had to quit some of the platforms. I'm wearing a shirt right now that I made. It says "Wonderful Servant, Terrible Master," and it's got a smartphone on it. Mm-hmm. You know, massaging the squirrel there. I know that. And Nir Eyal, a former two-time guest, he wrote a book called Hooked mm-hmm. with good intentions to try to help software designers create products that will help people using psychology to help people get good habits. Mm-hmm. But just like anything, can be used for good or bad. So with great power comes great responsibility.
It's a great topic. And you asked about responsibility. I agree entirely that us as designers and people who work in the design field, even though my job title isn't designer, we have to be responsible for the consequences of what we're designing. You're probably very familiar with dark patterns, that idea of you can create hooks in software or in games that encourage users to do things that aren't necessarily healthy or good for them. And one of the issues that games has faced is it's found a lot of these hooks much earlier because it's about entertainment, things that took the web or the internet until the last decade to learn. Games have been applying those same mechanics to encourage people to play more or to play longer for many years now. As designers, we need to recognize the impact that it really has on our users and stand up for the users to stop it. One of the reasons I think this occurs a lot, and we talked about metrics already today, is that focus on metrics. If, for example, a massively multiplayer game like EverQuest, if their designers are briefed with, okay, we want you to come up with a game that people will play 18 hours a day, and they'll check in first thing at the end of the day and last thing at the end of the day, you can create some mechanics that do that. And if you're focused exclusively on meeting those metrics, you will make something that's ultimately unhealthy for our users or our players. As designers, we need to be brave enough to step up and recognize these things, question the metrics, whether the things that we're measuring are the things that are important to, obviously, the things that are important to our business, businesses would like people to do this, but are they healthy for our users, and be brave enough to say no or find mitigating ways to make it better for our users when this occurs. That often can be very difficult. People have to put their jobs on the line to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do this. But ultimately, I think it's part of a designer's and user researchers, because we're in the design field as well, responsibility to be looking out for users, because no one in business is going to if we're not going to.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let's continue to advocate for the users at great cost, possibly sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you may have to say, I don't want to design this. I don't want to build this. I don't want to research around this. You may need to at times, and that's up to you. Use your ethics, use your instinct, defenders, to weigh that out. And I'm not pigeonholing video games. Again, like I said, I appreciate it. A lot of these things can be edge cases, right? But the fact remains that there are potentials around our software that we design that is meant to bring engagement, meant to grab attention. And sometimes we can lose our sense of reality. Mm-hmm. Right. And then virtual reality is coming along. Like, we have to be careful. I guess what I'm saying is we have to be careful, and we have to take a stand, and we have to tactfully try to educate our business folks around some of the ethical issues of it. I think that's our job. I don't expect our CEO, I don't expect our VPs, I don't expect our CFOs, I don't expect any of these folks to necessarily understand or be educated around behavioral science and around mm-hmm. some of these dangers. But I think that's our job to educate ourselves and to really be advocates for the users.
I agree entirely. Without going too deep on this, it's a very difficult thing to do in every way. It's difficult for designers, particularly designers early in their career, to say no, because they are worried, often quite rightly, with some tech companies that you might lose your job if you say, I'm not going to do this. But then all the way up to the top as well. So CEOs and the people who are setting these metrics or asking for more engagement or more logins or more time, they are incentivized by things like the stock market and the success of the business. It's their job to do unethical things. And so some people do need to stand up against that. And no one else is going to do it apart from our design friends.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Cue the Upton Sinclair quote. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it.
Exactly.
Right on. Well, thanks for, I appreciate you indulging me on that and answering that. And this isn't a FUD factor, a fear, uncertainty, doubt. I'm not trying to put any sort of dark connotation on video games at all. I'm not. I just felt like that was an important area to address. And I appreciate your response to that, Steve. It's hard to describe the unique and powerful web design experience of Editor X without actually seeing it, but I'll do my best. Editor X is a revolutionary platform unlike anything we've seen before, with unlimited design capabilities. In addition to the intuitive workspace that gives you total CSS control powered by smooth drag and drop, Editor X allows you to move effortlessly between up to 6 custom breakpoints to create unique website experiences that adapt to any viewport. And you can publish your finished masterpiece for all the world to behold in one simple click. Editor X has a massive range of integrated business solutions from e-commerce to bookings and event systems, so you can create sites for any type of business. All solutions are fully maintained in-house with no plugins, so you never have to worry about updates or security. It also comes with a collaborative workflow, including shareable design libraries with many more exciting new features on the way. Don't just listen to me attempt to describe it. You should really see it for yourself, unless you're driving or doing the clean and jerk. Just remember, after, to visit userdefenders.com/editorx to discover a new standard in web design. So with that, I'm curious, because I know, I mean, games, this is a big industry. Obviously, nobody can get a sneaking PS5. That's a good problem to have if you make a product, right? That's a good problem. So I have a feeling that a lot of the defenders listening, especially our UXR defenders, I have a feeling that they're intrigued about even pivoting or even pursuing a path along games user research. Mm-hmm. You're the guy to talk to about this. You wrote the book on it. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say, I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to recommend reading Steve's book when it's available. We'll have some. Maybe we can do a giveaway or something. I don't know. That'd be cool. To try to explore that,
but definitely
get a hold of his book. It's coming out pretty soon, within the next couple of months, I think. Is that correct?
At
the time of this recording?
It's out in February, so by the time people are listening to this, it will be available in
all
shops.
Right.
Yes.
We'll have a link in the show notes, yeah. Defenders. So what's the recommended path for one to become a video game UX researcher?
The first thing, I guess, to caveat is it's very difficult field to get into. Even getting a user research job anywhere, I guess, isn't the most easy task. There's a lot of people who want to work in user research, but there's very few user research dedicated roles out there. And that's even more so in the field of games. Typically only
large... Why is that?
I think the maturity of games, although as we talked about in the history thing, it has started very early. I think its adoption has been slower inside games than other types of software. One of the barriers, okay, I think, for that is games are an artistic medium. And so if you are a game designer, you are an artist creating art. And so that discussion a user researcher has about, okay, how do we incorporate an understanding of the player's experience and combine that with a piece of art can be more nuanced and difficult to get through than in other fields like e-commerce, where no one considers creating their website. That's unfair. I'm sure many people do consider it great art, but some people would not consider creating a website art in the same way that game designers think what they are doing are art. So because of that, games user researchers have to do a lot more advocacy work and explain what they're doing, which UXers have to do everywhere, I understand. But the consequence is there are not that many places that employ games user researchers. Often it's the larger studios, so Activision or Ubisoft or Eidos, or as you talked about, Microsoft and Sony. And that means that someone who wants to be a games user researcher often has to make big life moves, like move where they live, for example, to make that sort of commitment. And there are not that many roles out there. Because of that, people who are interested in being games user researchers have to be extremely proactive. But there's lots of opportunities out there. So for the last 5 years, I ran a mentoring scheme related to games user research, where we paired people who are already in the industry with people who are interested in joining the industry or just at the beginning of their career. And taking advantage of opportunities like that, or in the new book, we give a lot of examples about here are some ways to practice those user research skills without having the job, so that when that opening opens up and you have to apply for that job, you have a lot of relevant experience that you can talk about and you will ace that interview because it's competitive, a few jobs out there. One of the advantages, though, for games user research is that because it is quite a small community, it is very active and very friendly. And there's communities like Games Research and User Experience Special Interest Group who do things such as hosting this mentoring scheme I've mentioned. They have a Discord channel where they have a regular event. They run conferences and they do lots of things to make the field more accessible and to help people understand actually what is the job and how can I get those skills so I can ace an application for it.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate you mentioning that because in some of my research before our interview, I did see that there are groups out there. There's a community for everything, Defenders, as we talked about in the last episode as well with Jessica Gaddis. We talked about community, finding your community. They're there, and they're possibly looking for you, too, to lead them. So it's great, and it's not surprising to me that there are communities around this niche of video games user research. So we'll link to that in the show notes, Steve, because I have a feeling to me like that it's networking is so important, and networking with people that are doing what you want to do, it really makes a big difference because A, they're aware of you, and B, they may be able to help you. They may be able to answer questions. They may be able to find opportunities that you didn't even know existed yet because they're the first to hear.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly that. I should also mention they have a jobs board, so it will be the place where you find opportunities.
There we go.
Because every UXer is like this, but the games user research community, we are all strong advocates for games user research. We want to tell people why it's interesting. We want to tell people why it helps make games better. And because of that, that community of often very experienced user researchers are happy to spend their time talking to people about the field, to help people join, to get people excited about games user research. And so, yeah, just reach out because there are people there who are really happy to share everything they know about the field.
That's awesome. Yeah. I feel like it's important for me to round out my ethics statement. Video games can actually be a lifeline for some people too. Like this just occurred to me as I was thinking, even along the groundbreaking work, and I know firsthand Microsoft has done for disabled folks to be able to play video games. It's astonishing. It's actually moving. To see some of the commercials when you see this kid, he can hardly move, but guess what? He can play these games and he can bring entertainment, bring joy into his life. I think it's important for me to round out. There's good and bad. I mean, you can use anything for good and bad, but I think the good always wins. The good will always win. That touches me every time I see those commercials. I'm sure that Sony's doing things too. I just haven't heard as much around their console as I have with Microsoft Xbox and how they're really reaching the accessibility community and those with special needs.
Yeah, there's been a really exciting, I guess, advocacy and interest in that games accessibility space for perhaps the last 5 years. Things like custom hardware, like the work that Xbox has done, has been really exciting. And also a lot of software things. So through advocacy work from user researchers and other accessibility advocates, a lot of big games are now building in accessibility settings into the game. So if you have low vision or mobility issues or you're hard of hearing, the games will now, many big games like The Last of Us 2, which came out last year, have all the settings required so that you can still enjoy the game in the way that designers intended. Obviously, that journey has been difficult because games do have friction and challenge as part of it. A naive view that some game designers might have had in the past is that, oh, accessibility is just making games easier, and we don't want to make games easy because the difficulty is the point. But I think through education and advocacy, we've started to move the dial on that so that people recognise it's not making the game easier, It's making it so people can experience the game that you want them to experience in the way that has appropriate difficulty for them, which is a great ethos.
So great, man. Yeah. That just kind of came to my mind. I was like, I need to share this because this is every time I see those commercials, every time I hear about the work that's being done so that everyone is welcome. Mm-hmm. Everyone feels included to be able to experience these magnificent games that are available. It brings a lot of joy into a lot of folks' lives. I really think that's important. I appreciate that we got to touch on that a little bit.
Okay, great.
I kind of teased this a little bit earlier about synthesis and synthesizing data. I still do user research. Mm-hmm. I'm not a specialist like yourself. I'm a designer. I'm an interaction designer. That's my primary specialty, and I love it. I love thinking about how folks use an interface and how to make it better, how to make it easier, take friction out. I love thinking about that and designing solutions around that. But I also do appreciate user research very much because there's so many benefits. Any of us that we dive in, we start learning about user research, start doing it, like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense. Why did we wait so long to really make this an important part of our design discipline? So all that to say, I saw this in your book. I was like, oh my gosh, he's like, how did you know? In building user research teams, you say user research is a specialty. And if you're doing design and being tasked to do user research, you're probably going to be able to do both, but not both really well. And I'm like, dude, that's me. I love to hear your thoughts on that too, but I am setting this up about synthesizing. I'll be honest. I love talking to people. I love this. Mm. This is why I do a podcast. I love talking to you, and the one-on-one stuff is really great. And when I do user interviews, I enjoy the face-to-face. I enjoy watching them use and even struggle with products, although it's humbling. Once I get through all that, I honestly dread the synthesis of all the data I've gathered. It sometimes feels like digging a ditch to me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about it? And can you offer any advice to help me and any other defenders listening to love it more and reduce the pain of synthesizing more?
Yeah, I totally empathize. And I recognize that when you've got hundreds of post-its in front of you or hundreds of lines of text of what you've written and observed from a session, that can be overwhelming and intimidating to think about, okay, how am I going to dive into this and come back with something interesting and relevant and actionable from it. A thing that I feel is really important is the preparation that you do before you go into the study so that when you end up with your data, it's ready and easy to use. To be specific about that, whether it's a usability test where you're looking at some software and you know, okay, we're going to have these screens, or if it's an interview where we know, okay, we're going to talk about this topic, then we can talk about this topic. If you recognize that beforehand, you can capture your notes and put them in that section live. So every post-it I write about what they thought about the graphics, I'll put in this graphics section, for example. In the book, I talk about my fondness of mind maps, and I find mind maps are really helpful for that because you can predetermine what topics you're going to talk about, capture your notes live against those topics. And then when you realize and you're coming to an analysis, oh, actually, I put this in the wrong section. It's the work of seconds to move it from this area to this area, whereas that's not possible if you're looking at raw transcripts or fiddling with pictures or those kind of things. So by doing that rough sort live as you're capturing your notes, it helps mean that when you do come to synthesis, it's already vaguely in the right sort of area and a lot less intimidating to deal with. You still do need to then go reread through each section, work out, okay, what are the relevant observations about this theme, or what did we learn about this theme, and draw out the meaning from that, and then make sure you've communicated that meaning effectively. But it's a lot less intimidating if you've done that preparation to anticipate what we're going to talk about and then put it into the right section. So in general, I guess separating it into discrete tasks really helps. Prepare where you're going to capture the notes in those sections, then group the observations inside that section so you've only got a few observations, then reword it. Treating it as distinct tasks really helps break down that intimidating amount of synthesis you have ahead of you.
Oh, that's great advice, Steve. Thank you.
Right.
I selfishly received that feeling that a lot of the defenders listening are also really paying attention to that as well and So thank you for that. So what about reports? Do you find that you generally use the same template or do you have like several templates that you shift around or why? Kind of things like that real quick.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do often fall back on the same templates, and on the website for Building User Research Teams, which I think is buildinguserresearchteams.com, we have all these templates available to download. But
awesome.
Yeah, it can be lazy to rely on templates as well. Ultimately, the point of that report is to communicate what you as the researcher know with the person who needs to do something about it. And that requires just having a good relationship with your designer, your product manager, whoever the audience is. And then finding what works with you, whether that is a report, can be a conversation. Often I just go through the mind map with the person I'm talking to, and you don't need to write it up. Yeah, what works with your relationship is what's important.
Very nice. Jacob Nielsen wrote an article on Nielsen Norman Group. I'm sure you've read it. About how many users is enough. And the takeaway from that article on research that he's done on the fact that 6 or 7 generally is enough users for most of what you want to learn because of the law of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. Once you start exceeding 7, 8, 9, 10, you start to see the same results or similar results. I think the implication there is you might be wasting your time if you keep talking and spending an hour. It takes me at least an hour to do a one-on-one. I'm more of an introverted personality. I'm an ambivert. So it's very draining for me. Emotionally, it's draining. It's exhausting. So I never schedule more than 2 moderated interviews a day personally because I just can't take it. I'm ready to fall asleep after the first one. So all that to say, what's your take on this, on that statement, on that article from Jacob Nielsen? I call him Uncle Jakob. And how many users is enough, Steve?
I have a classic UXer answer to that question, which is, it depends. And what it
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, it depends on your research objective. So, yep, as you say, everyone's in the article, and there's some important parts about the article that we need to keep in mind when we're deciding is 5 to 8 users enough. He's describing for usability studies. So, if we're testing some software, yes, after 5 to 8 users, we will have seen a whole bunch of issues, and it's probably more worth what your while fixing those issues and then retesting than going on for another 10 or 20 users, because at that point you know what the issues are. You're just wasting time when you could be fixing those usability problems. But some bits that we might forget about when we're just quoting 5 to 8 users is it does depend on the research objectives. Not every study is a usability study. Sometimes you want to learn about user behavior in the real world. So for example, I mentioned a taxi app earlier. If you were inventing a taxi app, you would want to understand, okay, how do people go about ordering taxis currently and what's their experience? And for those type of studies, you want to first identify, okay, what types of users exist out there? People who are ordering a taxi are different from the taxi driver. So there's at least 2 audiences and we need to talk to both of those. And then how many of each of those audiences do we need to speak to depends on too many factors that you can't guess in advance. So you will start speaking to people, and after 5 to 8 users, 5 to 8 taxi drivers, for example, you should take a call on, okay, am I hearing the same thing again and again? Have I understood everything about this? Or am I still learning new things and I haven't yet hit that saturation point where it's just repeating the same information again? And for those type of studies, you can't come up with a hard and fast rule in the same way, because you don't know how different that audience are until you get in there with them and start talking to them. And then only then will you know, okay, now I can stop when I've heard it all before.
Hey, everybody. This is Joe Natoli, UX consultant, speaker, and author, and I fight for the users. You are listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
Awesome. I appreciate that. So before I get into the Super 7, I like to go below the surface.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the defenders like to listen to the show, because it's not just about design. It's not just about research. It's not just about UX. I think that, and I believe, I don't just think, I believe that being a great designer or UX person begins and ends with being a great human. It really does. And empathy, that's all part and parcel, right? This work requires empathy for our users and advocating for them, fighting for them. I want to know, Steve, what's your why? Like, why do you do what you do?
Oh, that's a great question. It's a really interesting space to work in. All you do all day as a user researcher is understand real people's life experience in different contexts. And that's tremendously interesting. There's always new things about learning, okay, these are all real people doing real things and they're all different from me. And so I guess it exposes you to how broad users as a category are and what people are like in the real world. And I think that's endlessly interesting. I also think that it's nice to be able to make experiences better for people. What you'd learn from any usability study is that there's problems with almost every piece of software. Everything is confusing to someone. And by doing this job, we can make things less confusing to people and reduce the amount of pain in the world. So I think it's that combination of learning how interesting the world is and also trying to make that world slightly better for just that few number of people who are using your software.
Ah, thanks, man. That's good. That's inspiring.
Yes.
Yeah. And curiosity is really a big part of that, right? You really need to stay curious and hungry to really continue to thrive and do good in this area.
Yeah, exactly. I guess you can't assume you've heard it all because then you stop listening to people. And then what's the point of running these studies if we're not paying attention?
That's good stuff. So let's jump into the Super 7 before we wrap up here. Steve, what's your UX superpower?
Oh, yes. So I think it's reflection. A thing we haven't talked about yet is I've been very lucky and worked with some very good researchers in the past. So, for example, David Tisserand was one of the senior researchers who I worked with at PlayStation. And what he taught me was how important it was to recognize that research is a semi-structured process. You always do recruitment, you always design your study, you always moderate a session, you always analyze your findings, you always present it. And if you recognize it, it's all these discrete phases, you can then interrogate, okay, what went well about each of these phases? What didn't go well? And what can we do differently next time to make the study go better or to learn more interesting things? And I think with that core skill of reflecting on the process and then making changes to do it differently next time, that's all you need. You can start from no research process at all and iterate your way up to it very quickly. And I guess this is one of the themes of the first book, Building User Research Teams, is how do you recognize those phases and how do you continually iterate to make them better?
Oh, very cool. Reflection.
Yes.
That's great. And I think in the world that we live in, that's, again, constantly vying for our attention, I think that seems to be somewhat of a lost skill and a lost art. I think that we're constantly moving. This is an assumption, but I'll speak for myself. I feel like the world we live in, which is wonderful, and we're grateful to have the technologies we have, again, as mentioned previously. But with that, we tend to forget to slow down, even stop, and just reflect and think. And I appreciate that because that's not just a good UX skill. That's a good life skill.
Yeah.
For Pete's sake. So, yeah. So that's, I wanted to just kind of comment on that. I think that that's a great skill altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something we can practice in every aspect of our life, like you say.
What's your UX kryptonite, conversely?
I guess the thing I don't like to see and try and avoid is the idea of inefficiency, which I guess plays back to those reflection themes. So I think fundamentally, I, like perhaps many people, am quite lazy. And so I'd like to deliver the results in the most effective way without wasting time or wasting effort. What I'm trying to achieve through this reflection is identify what can we do differently or stop doing that is a waste of our time. Because of that, inefficiency in the design process is something that I try and avoid.
There's a lot of different points to that that are interesting to me. One of them is in UX, we're told to fail fast, right? We should be encouraged to fail. And yet some, especially higher ups, may look at failure as inefficiency. So there's like a weird dichotomy there, right? It's like you really should be trying to fail, but fail fast. I think we framed failure in the wrong light, especially again, older school folks or higher ups or what have you. They may not feel like there's enough room in the budget to be inefficient, at least initially.
Yeah.
Like, can you speak to that? Do you have any thoughts on that dichotomy there?
Yeah, I guess it takes a certain amount of design maturity to recognize the value of failing and to recognize that by doing this, we are ultimately going to get to our destination faster because we have learned something from this experience. We're going to do something differently and we have that same North Star goal that we've always been aiming for, but our approach is different. And then through education about the design process, we can hopefully help people understand that although we've called this a failure, this isn't a step back. It's a step towards the goal that we're trying to reach.
Yeah, I like that. I think Facebook's mantra for a long time was move fast and break things. I don't think that's helped our field. I don't think that's helped software very much. I'm of the belief that we should move slow and fix things. But the reality is some of the biggest innovators in the world are maybe at heart, they might be lazy bums.
I know I am.
They're tired of doing things manually. You know, I mean, I'm the same way. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot to glean there. I appreciate that, Steve. Yeah. This is a fun one. What would your UX superhero name be?
Yes, the slightly corny name, Reflector. So in honor of that idea of let's look at what we're doing in the research process, let's measure its success, let's adjust and learn and make changes. I think that idea of reflecting on the research process is that ethos of the first book and something that I'm still extremely enthusiastic about.
That's great. Yeah. I love that. Reflector. Can't wait to see your art, Eli Jorgensen's art. So what's one habit you believe contributes to your success?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of documenting what I'm doing as I'm going. So I've been lucky in my roles where I've been in the position to set up a number of user research teams. And by writing the templates and the processes as I'm establishing them, that becomes a learning resource that as the team scales and grows, people can learn from what you're doing. And you wouldn't have time to go back to these things. So after you've started to hire people and grown your team, you'll never have time to go back and write up how we do research or how we recruit participants or how we analyze things. So doing that as you go along, I think is tremendously valuable and a thing that's paid off a number of times in my career.
That's great, man. Yeah, documenting what you're doing, that's good. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you could recommend to our listeners?
Is a book appropriate or?
Absolutely, yeah.
A book I think is extremely useful. Perhaps you've seen it before, but Just Enough Research by Erica Hall. I think it's fantastic, isn't it? If you're a solo researcher or a member of someone representing research and organization, it's quite a brief book and it just tells you everything you need to know about here's the ethos behind research, here's the activities that you could be doing, and it is a no-nonsense guide to explaining this is how you be a user researcher. I recommend it to everyone who joins a team that I'm on or who I work with as a user researcher.
So my last question for you, Steve, is what is your best advice for defenders looking to get their foot in the door as a UXR or user researcher, and let's even say as a games user researcher?
Yeah, I think this goes back to some of the themes we talked about already today. So my advice is find a community, the community for games user research. But as you said, there's a community in every aspect of UX and design, I imagine. Be open with that community. Tell people you're new, you're learning, and just be proactive, enthusiastic about, okay, I'm on my journey, I'm going to make some mistakes, but taking advantage of those people around you who are there to help is extremely valuable. Yeah, so that's my advice for people who are interested in becoming games user researchers.
Awesome. That's great advice. Before we wrap, do you have anything else you want to share or anything else you want to leave us with?
No, I thank you very much for taking the opportunity to talk about this today. As I've mentioned a number of times, the games user research community, we talked about games research and user experience special interest group. That's fantastic, so check them out. We also mentioned the book, How to Be a Games User Researcher. A lot of the themes you talked about go into more depth in the book, so that's also a great place to look. Or if people want to chat about games user research, I'm always available on Twitter, Steve_Bromley.
Perfect. And defenders, definitely keep an eye out for the book. I'll link to it in the show notes so you'll be able to pick it up there. Is it going to be on Amazon?
It will, I imagine.
Okay, great. So defenders, if you pick it up through the show notes page, I have an affiliate with Amazon. So I'll get a really small piece of that pie at no additional cost to you. So please buy it from the show notes, userdefenders.com/076, I believe. I hope I got that right. So yeah, Steve, thank you so much, man, for being here. This is really been insightful. I've learned a lot personally, and I know the defenders have as well. This is really exciting stuff. I feel like this area of user research is very nascent. I feel like there's a lot of growth happening here and will continue along this trajectory. Again, try to get a PS5, defenders. Try. Just try. I dare you. And if you have one already, you're lucky. But yeah, this is a really interesting, exciting field. I'm going to continue to keep a pulse on it, and definitely excited to read your book, Steve, myself. So that's about it, man. Thank you so much. And as always, last but not least, I just want to say, fight on, my friend. Up, up, down, down, left, right, BA start. Who remembers that infamous Infinite Lives Konami cheat code on the original Nintendo? Oh, it takes me back. It was really fun reminiscing about the video games of my youth with Steve, and of course, diving into the nuances of user research from a gaming perspective. User researcher defenders, if games you are is an area you're interested in pursuing, you should definitely consider picking up Steve's brand new book, How to Be a Games User Researcher. I have an Amazon affiliate link in the show notes at userdefenders.com/076, meaning, if you buy it there, you'll be helping UD at no additional cost to you. This is also a good time to mention that I have in my possession, thanks to Steve, 4 signed copies of his new book to give away. Here's how you can enter to win one. Simply join the UD email list at userdefenders.com/join from the time of this airing through the end of March 2021, and you'll automatically be entered to win a free signed copy of Steve's book. You can certainly unsubscribe at any time. There's no pressure at all, although I'd hope you wouldn't. I've had this email list for 5 years and counting, and have never sold out any of my defenders. And by the hammer of Grabthar, I never will. Again, be sure to go to userdefenders.com/join ASAP, unless you're driving or doing the clean and jerk. Then just wait until after and
get to the chopper!
If you've been a listener for any length of time, you know that I always try to come up with my own Springer's final thought to close out the episodes. I actually struggled a little coming up with one for this episode, if I'm being honest. And then I reflected a little about Steve and my important dialogue on ethics in gaming. There was a really nice, unintentional juxtaposition around the dark and light side of gaming. Of course, the dark side is when game designers, likely strongly influenced by the pressures of C-suite, use psychology hooks to keep folks playing as long and often as possible without designing in healthy cues like, hey, you've been playing for 16 hours. How about a bathroom break or something? Or why don't you go outside for some fresh air for a bit? I'll be here when you get back. That's our responsibility, designers and defenders, is to speak up and truly be defenders of our users, if indeed we are user defenders. And then the light side of how Microsoft in particular is being so intentional about creating consoles that meet the accessibility community right where they're at, so everyone can play and we all win. The reality is there are many things meant for good that are used for evil. And the implications for us designers is to be careful what we put into the world, knowing our users will not always use it in the ways we intend, for better or for worse. Kranzberg's first law states that technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. Truly, Uncle Ben, at least in the first Spider-Man movie, was right. With great power comes great responsibility. To bring this full circle, when I was looking up the origin of the Konami Code, I was shocked to read that Konami paid out an unknown settlement to the families of 2 troops killed in the Desert Storm War who apparently thought the Konami cheat code would give them infinite lives on the battlefield. But alas, turns out the M16s they were wielding did not match Nintendo's game controller. We don't get infinite lives, we only get one. But one that does come straight from the manufacturer with an infinite afterlife. Let's make them count. Tweet your takeaways, defenders. I'm at User Defenders, and Steve is at Steve_Bromley. We definitely would love to engage with you around the episode, how it impacted your life and your UX career. I want to take a second to thank two new patrons of the show, Kane Cathane and Orit Weinstein. Thank you both so much for believing in me and what I'm doing with the show, and it does help offset a lot of the bills that are associated with keeping the lights on with this show. Defenders, if you're interested in checking out the Patreon, you can go to userdefenders.com/Patreon. There's all sorts of neat little perks and things you can only get there. I want to also thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, as always. And I want to thank Editor X for sponsoring this episode and the previous one. Thank you so much for your support as well. Again, I said it in the last episode, I mean it. If you're wanting to get a portfolio out quick, don't do what I did and try to hand code it. It may never be done. Definitely try Editor X and see how that platform can help you streamline. I believe it will help you streamline the creation of your portfolio, because I know how hard it is personally to struggle with being laid off or just being in transition. So definitely don't waste any more time and try Editor X and see what they can do for you in helping you get your work online quickly so you can start getting looked at by recruiters. Check it out, userdefenders.com/EditorX. That's it, defenders. I want to thank you so much again for listening. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there and a lot of choices. So I just thank you for coming back time and again, for staying subscribed, even when there's a big lull between episodes, which, as you know, can happen with me. I've been really, really inundated at work, in a good way, of course, but there's been a lot going on. So I'm doing what I can. I definitely have some interviews I'm lining up now, some really, really cool ones. I won't spoil it yet, but I'm working on some great interviews for future content as well. So definitely stay plugged in. Again, join the email list. I'm going to try to get better. I'm honestly not great at sending emails, but I'm going to try to do better there. Twitter has been great, but I just feel like the engagement's not there that much. Twitter's doing a lot of gatekeeping. There's a lot of controlled speech and stuff happening there. I just don't know if it's going downhill like Facebook or what, but I feel like I'm going to try to invest a little more time and effort into my email list. So I'd love to have you there. And again, if you join the email list from now, the time you're hearing this, through the end of March of 2021, you will automatically be entered to win one of Steve's books. So definitely do that. userdefenders.com/join. My goodness, this outro is long. If you're still here, God love you. Thanks for being along on this journey and this journey into this outro, me finishing my sign off here. So reach out anytime on Twitter or again on the email list. I'm at User Defenders on Twitter. And that's it. Until next time, fight on, my friends.